Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I will start out today with some good news. My college roommate's son is progressing very well. I mean, it's not, you know, he's not running marathons or anything, but he is speaking. He is increasing in his ability to react and speak, and to even do things like swallow that we kind of take for granted. He's really wanting to eat real food. He still kind of has to eat pureed food and kind of doesn't like that. But I think, you know, things are very much moving in the right direction. And from what I have seen on Facebook, I think somewhere near the third week of February, they will release him from the Shepherd Center. And then he will be in sort of an outpatient thing for another 3 weeks. And then somewhere in May, somewhere in March, he will actually be returning to their home in South Carolina. Coming a long way. It's a lot of work. It's, you know, it's a day-by-day thing. It's been very interesting. I say that interesting. It's interesting because I don't have to go through it. And isn't that the way it is? You know, you experience things vicariously, but they're not really you. So to you, they're interesting. To other people, it's life and death. And, you know, every day is something you wake up and have to choose to be grateful for. And that's sort of what we're talking about in Job, having a different perspective on those things that we feel like we can't control. And today we kind of bring it back to that. We finally, as we get to chapter 40 in Job, all the talking is done except for God. And we've read a couple of chapters now where God has questioned Job. When we come to this first part of 40, where Job is finally, you know, there's a breath. God kind of pauses for a moment and basically gives Job a moment to say something. And we're going to talk about that. And then we're going to talk about God's last session with Job a bit, because there's some things in there that are certainly things we want to talk about. I don't know that we'll get to the very end today, but we should get through most of that. But again, you want to keep all this in your mind, as the purpose of Job is to give us a perspective that's other than ours on the stuff that we experience that we feel like we have no part in and no control over. And how do we, as people of faith, respond in that environment? And what we're getting is this ancient story of a man who had to do that, and he did not have all the revelation that we have. We've received much more than Job had. So that's kind of where we are. So let's go to chapter 40, verse 1. I think we started this the other day, but we're going to kind of jump back there again. Okay, I'm starting out NIV, okay? All right. So the Lord said to Job, "Will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him?" So he's addressing Job. He's saying, "You the man." So he's contending, you know, the positioning is that he's contending with God. And, you know, almost this, are you careful you're not crossing over the line, Job, in, you know, in the things that you've said, the emotions that you've expressed? Are you really thinking you're going to correct me? Then he says, "Let him who accuses God answer him." So, you know, it's sort of like he's pulling off the layers of the onion and saying, "Job, you're really kind of stepping over the bounds. I understand what you're going through, but you're really kind of stepping over." Then Job answered the Lord. He says, "I am unworthy. How can I reply to you?" That's probably the smartest thing he said in quite a while. "I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I will say no more." Which, again, is probably the smartest thing that Job has said in quite a while. Now, he's saying that in response to all those questions that God posed to him. All those questions, whenever God said, did you, did I, did you, did you, did you, did you, did you, did you, okay, about how the world is created, how, you know, how the universe runs without Job's input, you know. All of that was to remind Job that God was in charge, that he was sovereign, that he could take care of the way things are sustained. Thank you very much. And were you there when I set it all in motion? Now, all that could be very impersonal if we left it at that. Okay? The fact that God would speak to Job and actually speak to him at all is a pretty remarkable thing if we keep it in context. Because this is not just, if me and Anthony are buddies, okay? And Anthony sees me making, you know, getting angry, getting over, and saying things about him that maybe I shouldn't say, okay? If Anthony really cares about me, whether I'm going off on him or somebody else, a friend says, whoa, let's talk about this man to man. And that's essentially what God's doing with Job. This is God, who's already just gone through this litany of questions to prove that Job is not God. But yet, he's addressing Job and saying, let's talk about this man to man. That's pretty remarkable. It emphasizes that there is a relationship of some type here. So we've got Job. What is in the face of all these questions that God has posed, all these situations that God has reminded Job of, what is Job's attitude and response in respect to it? Because remember, we have still not yet had said anything about, Job, you did this, fess up, dude. You realize that? The questions don't have anything to do with Job's sin. The questions have to do with God's character and what Job is saying about God's character and purpose and plan and sovereignty. I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I spoke once. I'm not going to do it again. So how would you paraphrase Job's response to all that stuff that God has said? You could, but it's repentance for what? His own integrity. Yes, he did. There's stuff you don't know, you don't understand. And so how do you think Job then is, how's he responding to that? So would you say his response is, okay, I get it. I agree that I think he understands what God is saying and that he understands that God is right. All of a sudden, all that emotion, here's another thing. God is questioning Job. All that emotion that we have seen whenever Job has ranted and we have said, we understand that emotion, we get that, okay? God is talking to Job. And for Job, that is a lot of where the emotion came from. He felt like God was other, disengaged, not with him. Does this make sense? And so here you have God actually talking to Job in the narrative. So a lot of the emotion of the separation, and it's not that Job feels like God pointed his finger at him and did. It's that God actually took the time to talk to me out of the storm. So some of the emotion, God did correct his context and his perspective, but God took the time to address Job. So between those two things, the redirect that God gave him and the fact that God let him talk. We can't forget the significance of just what's there. Okay. Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. So it's the second time he speaks to him out of the storm again. It says again, brace yourself like a man. Okay. So we're going to talk man to man. Now I will question you, and you shall answer me. So, we're going to launch out now, and we're going to get a whole nother series of questions. So we've talked about God's sovereignty, His authority, His power to create, His power to sustain. Now, we're going to look at some illustrations, and we need to evaluate why God would use those to talk to Job. Why would He give him those questions? We're going to get there. All right. Will you really annul my judgment? Will you condemn me that you may be justified? Wow. Do you think Job was really doing that? Maybe. Is he condemning God that then his own integrity would be impugned? I don't think Job means to do that. He just wants to know why, and he's aching so bad that are you like that? That sometimes You will exaggerate in the heat of your emotion. You will exaggerate. Y'all don't do that, do you? Okay, I do. And I think Job is having, God's asking him that. He says, will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Let him who approves God answer it. Yep. Oh, thank you. Okay, we go from 8 to 9. Okay, there we go. There we go. Okay. Or do you have an arm like God, and can you thunder with a voice like His? Adorn yourself with eminence and dignity, and clothe yourself with honor and majesty. Pour out the overflowings of your anger, and look on everyone who is proud and make him low. Look on everyone who is proud and humble him and tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them in the dust together, bind them in the hidden place. Then I will also confess to you that your own hand can save you. So God does all these things. Now, the situation, the context is different here. What are the things that God is talking about and questioning Job about right now? Do you have an arm like mine? Whenever you see Scripture talking about arm, what is that allusion to a lot of times? The arm. Strength, okay? And so the arm is the one that inflicts, afflicts. Okay, here we're talking about in areas of, why would somebody, it says in verse 11, you look in 11, it says, unleash the fury of your wrath, look at every proud man, and bring him low. So what's God doing here? We're looking at the illustration or the illusion of the arm and then the proud. And what does that arm do to the proud? Okay? So what is that relationship there? God is doing what in that action? What is Satan's sin? What is God doing in this illustration? What's God doing in this as He's asking these questions? What is the image? God does what? Okay, why does He need humbling? I'm trying to do this in a way that I don't just say this. Is God talking here about Job being the one who's proud? Okay, all right. Verse 11 is the pivot point, okay? So at verse 11 there it says, I'm going to read the NIV because I think it helps a little bit, okay? So in verse 9 it says, do you have an arm like God's? So obviously, what's the answer to that question? Okay. All right. And can your voice thunder like His? No. Okay. Thunder a lot of times has to do with the idea of what? In Scripture. Has to do with judgment. Okay. Then adorn yourself with glory and splendor and clothe yourself in honor and majesty. Unleash the fury of your wrath. So He's saying, if you're like God, do this. And why would He tell Job to do this? It's because this is what God does. He's saying, okay, you're going to act like God, then do this. And whenever you come across people like this, do this. You be the one who punishes these rascals. You be the one who sets it right. You be the one who puts the proud in their place. You do it, because this is what God does. It's what I do. That's what He's saying. God is saying, this is what I do. Can you do that like I do, Job? This is what I do. Now, does it make a little more sense? He's saying, look at every proud man and humble him. Crush the wicked where they stand. Bury them in all the dust. And bury them all in the dust together. Shroud their faces in the grave. Then I myself will admit to you that you can save yourself. In other words, if you can do all this stuff like I do against those who are proud and arrogant and evil, then you can call yourself God. You can say you're as powerful as I am. Now, the key is what we learn about God. It's that God is the one who is capable of judging and terminating evil. Job can't do it. Job doesn't understand. Okay? Job doesn't understand. He's been afflicted. He's lashed out at God. And God is saying, You don't have that ability like I do. Okay? And when you do, Job, then you can call, you can put yourself on that place. All right? So now we're going to go into an illustration with verse 15. So it says, behold now Behemoth, which I made as well as you. Okay, in other words, made you, I made him. He eats grass like an ox, Behold now his strength in his loins and his power in the muscles of his belly. He bends his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs are like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. Let his maker bring near his sword. Surely the mountains bring him food, and all the beasts of the field play there. Under the lotus plants he lies down in the covert of the reeds and the marsh. What are we talking about here? What is Behemoth?
And how literal do we take this?
And who made Behemoth? Yes, that is true. There is also some symbolic attachment to this. In this series of questions, God is quoted as talking about Behemoth and Leviathan as literal creatures. Maybe a little poetically expanded, but they are real creatures that are being referenced. Okay, some people want to talk about it as being a hippopotamus and a crocodile because they are indigenous to Egypt. I don't know. Okay, all I know is that some of the description of these creatures does not match what I would think goes traditionally with those two. Now, is the description based upon them? I don't know. But the reason why it has to do with why these two creatures are brought up is because also symbolically they relate to the Middle, to nations in the Middle East. And those nations are not God-fearing nations. They are nations who are outside of God's ability to bless. And so you've got the Behemoth and you've got Leviathan, and there is this ascent, there's sort of this, God created them, can he not keep them in check? So God allows people, allows evil to exist because Satan chose to rebel. He allows him for a time, but you and I can't see there is a termination date. So what he's got here is these two creatures that he describes, Behemoth and Leviathan, where he talks about how big and strong and you know, seemingly impenetrable. And yet this is, and yet God created this creature, and he is still able to reel him in, which is where we're going to go. God's in charge of this. Yes, that is correct. And this is so old that I'm going to defer to other people who will wax eloquent on that subject. I'm not saying that it couldn't be. I'm not saying that it isn't. I'm just going to say there's a whole lot of ways you can look at this, and that could be one of them. No matter what, it's saying that there's the idea that this creature is evil. This is a creature that pushes the envelope, and God is in charge of that creature. He can reel them in. He can control them. You know, that kind of thing. I'm not getting into the idea of God created evil. That's not what this passage is about. It's just saying that you have to understand there's all these ideas attached to these concepts. So this creature says the lotus plants cover him with shade, the willow of the brooks surround him. If a river rages, he is not alarmed. He is confident. Though the Jordan rushes to his mouth, can anyone capture him when he is on watch with barbs? Can anyone pierce his nose? Whenever I read that, the first thing I'm thinking of is if you're talking about creatures, there's no way this is a hippopotamus because a hippopotamus does not have a tail like a cedar, literally. So, you know, those who want to argue for that, maybe it was they thought of a hippopotamus and expand. I don't know. I don't know. But that part of the description surely does not match what I would think a hippopotamus would be. Okay. You with me so far? All right, so then we got in verse 41, can you, Job, draw out Leviathan with a fish hook or press down his tongue with a cord? So this is a huge creature from the ocean, the water. Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many supplications to you, or will he speak to you soft words? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him for a servant forever? Now, remember, God is saying to Job, can you do this? And the reason why he's asking him is because God is saying, I can. I have. It is the way. So, if you look at that, can God subdue evil? That is what that is saying. He can control that huge creature that would be frightening, threatening, perhaps evil. Will you play with him like as a bird? Will you bind him for your maidens? In other words, as a sort of a entertainment. Will the traders bargain over him? Will they divide him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle. You will not do it again. Or in other words, God's saying, I'd like to see that. Behold, your expectation is false. You will be laid low even at the sight of him. I wonder, as one who toys with literature from time to time, whether this kind of thing maybe had something to do with Moby Dick. No one is so fierce that he dares to arouse him. Who is he that can stand before me? Who is given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. Then he says in verse 12, I will not keep silence concerning his limbs or his mighty strength or his orderly frame. So it says limbs, and if we're talking about Leviathan and he lives in the water, it would be really, you know, if you're talking about a crocodile-like creature, at least he does have limbs. His orderly frame, who can strip off his outer armor, who can come within his double mail, who can open the doors of his face. Around his teeth there is terror. His strong scales are his pride, shut up as with the tight seal. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. They are joined to one to another. They clasp each other and cannot be separated. His sneezes flash forth light. Now, the last time I've seen, I haven't ever seen a crocodile do that. His eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning torches. Sparks of fire leap forth. It sounds a lot more like a dragon than it does a crocodile. Out of his nostrils, smoke goes forth as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals and a flame goes forth from his mouth. In his neck lodges strength and dismay leaps before him. Now, dismay doesn't leap. So in other words, if you're in front of this, this creature, you're running. The folds of his flesh are joined together, firm on him and immovable. His heart is as hard as a stone, even as hard as a lower millstone. When he raises himself up, the mighty fear, because of the crashing, they are bewildered. The sword that reaches him cannot avail, nor the spear, the dart, or the javelin. He regards iron as straw, bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones are turned into stubble for him. Clubs are regarded as stubble. He laughs at the rattling of the javelin. His underparts are like sharp potsherds. He spreads out like a threshing sledge on the mire. He makes the depths boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a jar of ointment. Behind him, he makes a wake to shine, or one would think the deep to be gray-haired. Nothing on earth is like him, one made without fear. He looks on everything that is high. He is king over all the sons of pride. So you see, in all of this, God in this dialogue, in this part of what he's saying, is saying, who's in charge or who controls these evil powers? Who reels them in? Who controls them? Who has the ability to do that? Who is it? It's God. Job, have you been doing that lately? And so in saying that, God is positioning Job to understand who's in charge of right and wrong. Who gets to determine who's right and wrong? Who reels in right and wrong? Okay, so Job, what you got to say about that, Willis? Sorry, I revert back to those TV things. Okay, yeah. So do you see why he's asking him these questions? You don't want to get lost in all the stuff about the behemoth and Leviathan, even though you have to kind of look at it a little bit. You don't want to get too lost in that. the reality is, what is he saying to Job about how Job's lack of his bottom-up understanding of what's going on? Job doesn't understand because Job isn't God. So, put that into our framework. Whenever we come to try to understand and create a theology of trouble and problems, what does that say to us?
Okay.
Okay. We can't explain it. So, okay. Go ahead, Heidi. No. Now, it's not to say that we don't have a theology of trouble, an understanding of what's going on in the world or acknowledging we're not saying, oh, there's no such thing as evil. There's no such thing as trouble. Things, everything happens and we can construct a reason. That would be that problem. But if we say, yes, we know that things happen that we don't understand, or it's a lot different than saying, Heidi, what did you do that created your back problem? That's the question for any of us. But that would be, Rick, what did you do that caused you to have X issue? Yes. Yeah, my chocolate allergies. Yeah, what did I do at 3 and a half whenever to give me a chocolate allergy? Yeah. Whatever that might be. Whatever the trouble would be. And God's in charge. So what is it that we do? How do we respond to this? What is the answer? Okay? We learn from this part of this passage, from this part of this narrative. Did all Job's emotions and did any of that change what God did? Okay. Did God talk to Job because God felt like Job was calling him to an audience? No. God was, if anything, was saying, look, we've got this relationship. I'm actually going to have this man-to-man talk with you. So in our trouble, what does that tell us? That God will come to us. We may not hear what we want to hear. He may say, look, yeah, you didn't do anything. This is not because you sinned or your parents sinned or somebody caused this to happen to you. But then again, I'm in charge. And can you trust me through it, even though you don't understand? And I said that a long time ago, that I find that essentially what Job is about coming to an ability to trust God when we don't understand the trouble. Will we trust God? Will we see what God is like? Do we believe that He is in charge? Do we believe that He is sovereign? Do we believe that He is providing? Do we believe that He is the one who keeps a rein on evil and deals with evil? Because we can't do that. It's bigger than us, but He can. And we got to trust Him. Okay? Anything that you're thinking, you got a question on, a comment on, roll this around in your mind for a while and tell me what you think. The answer, whatever the answer is always in the relationship. Even if you don't get all the answers you want, whatever answers there are in the relationship. So the one thing we don't want to do is abandon the relationship. And one thing that we see in Job is that even though Job is not right whenever he steps over the lines, he is right that it was not his sin. It was not a sin that caused this. The relationship, though, is the thing. Relationship is not what Eliphaz, Zophar, and Bildad are talking about. They are talking about something other than a relationship. And for Job, what God is saying is that you're not God, but I like the... It's almost like he's going to say, Job, you're human. I get that. I created you. But at the same time, what you need to do is stay in relationship with me and trust me. And if you'll do that, you won't get all your answers, but you'll be okay. And we'll see that really clear whenever we finish. At least I think so. Okay? Please read this last chapter, which is, I think, 42. Okay? It's the end of this. And then look at 42. Bring ideas and thoughts and questions whenever we meet to finish, because I want to finish well. Okay? Okie dokie. Anthony, close us in prayer.